Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a virtual trip to the zoo today with our guests and find out what it's like to care for the animals. And we'll find out how the zoo runs. We'll probably talk about other zoos as well, perhaps, with our two guests who are from the Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. First, the zoo curator, Beth Peterson, one of our guests. Beth, hi, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
And with us as well, primary veterinarian, Dr. Mary Thurber. Dr. Mary, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Mary Thurber is also a clinical instructor in zoological medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. So as we talk with them about zoo animals and the Vilas Park Zoo, I hope you'll join in. What's your favorite Wisconsin Zoo? What questions do you have about caring for the animals? You can join in. Easy to do. Just call 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or you can shoot us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Beth, let's start with you. What does a zoo curator do?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, for the most part, an easy way to say it is that I'm in charge of all of the animals at the zoo and all of the people that take care of the animals at the zoo. So, you know, often if you look back to the word curator, it means collecting. And nowadays, we don't do so much collecting of animals. We definitely are using our other zoo affiliates across the United States or even further abroad to bring in zoo animals that have most often been bred in captivity or have found themselves without a home due to you know, any sort of pressure in their natural environment, or maybe they've been orphaned. So I do work hard on bringing in animals to the zoo that need a home or we have space for in our current exhibits, and also looking ahead to the future as we have some big plans in place for the next, you know, few decades and thinking ahead about what animals we want to be a part of that or could be a part of that. And then, you know, always making sure that we're working on things to keep the guests and the keepers safe in their day-to-day visits here and making sure that the zoo's a great place to learn about animals. So, yeah, it's a really exciting job and I look forward to coming to work every day.
Sounds like you don't have hardly anything to do. Seems like a pretty busy job to be, actually. How did you become a curator?
Well, I actually started at Henry Vilas Zoo 15 years ago as a zookeeper. And even further back, you know, I am from the area and I had birthday parties here when I was little. I never thought I'd get a job here. So long, long ago, I won't say how far back, otherwise I'll really date myself. Long, long ago, there used to be a children's zoo area with camel rides, and you could have your birthday there and raise the flag on the flagpole, and it was all a really big deal for someone that loved animals when they were 6 or 7 or 8 years old. So from there, I went to the University of Wisconsin River Falls and really wanted to be a vet like Dr. Thurber, and then realized that maybe I needed to come up with an alternate path after a couple of chemistry classes. So here I am. I got the job at Henry Vilas Zoo after working at a couple of other zoos across the U.S. 15 years ago, and have been here ever since. You know, I was promoted to zoo manager and then curator about 3 years ago, and really enjoy my role. And I'm excited for taking our zoo to the next place and being a part of that every day.
That is very, very cool. Dr. Mary Thurber, let's turn to you for a minute. Let's talk about your responsibilities as the primary vet at the Vilas Zoo.
Yeah, I would say they are very varied and really every day is totally different. But my overall sort of responsibility is managing both the preventive health for the collection. So making sure animals are up to date on their vaccines, doing routine annual exams. And some of that is discussions with the curator and the managers about, you know, are we going to get hands on the animals? Or are we going to do visual exams? What makes the most sense for each animal for their sort of routine health? Then we also are on call always for any emergencies that come up. So during the day, either going to look at an animal that needs an assessment, talking to managers, looking at photos, depending. You know, sometimes we do some virtual medicine. If I'm not physically at the zoo, we can send photos or videos and have some conversations that way. We're also really fortunate to have a really wonderful veterinary technician on grounds at the zoo. So sometimes he'll be my first line of eyes, so he can go look at an animal for me. And then we can have further discussions about the next plan for that animal. And in addition to that, like Beth was mentioning, we do a lot of movement of animals in the zoos. So we take care of animals if they've come in from a new zoo, we'll keep them in quarantine for a certain period. So we'll evaluate the animals during quarantine and do routine quarantine testing. And then on the other side, if we're actually going to send out an animal to a different zoo, they will request certain tests that they would like to have that animal undergo before they are shipped out. So we'll do the pre-shipment testing as well as the quarantine testing for those animals while they're being moved. And then probably the other really biggest part of my job is that I'm a teacher. And so I work for the vet school, and we have veterinary residents. So they're doing a 3-year program through the vet school in zoo medicine. So they'll rotate through with me. And then we'll also have 4th-year veterinary students who come through on rotations. And so they get to come along on all of our vet checks, be a part of the physical exam, diagnostic testing, treatment plans for all the animals. And, you know, at the end of the day, we'll look at the x-rays, we'll look at the blood work together and talk through, you know, what we think is going on with the animal and what the next best step is.
Oh, that all really cool things. Are there any misconceptions that people have, or do you ever notice about your job?
Great question. Probably people think I get to play with animals way more than I do. Actually, the most animals in the zoo don't necessarily like to be touched by a doctor. So the majority of our animals, you know, we actually have to put under anesthesia to do a full physical exam or to get blood work from. So, you know, that's definitely different. I sadly don't get to play with puppies and kittens, but sometimes when we're so lucky as we are right now at the zoo, we have some otter pups. So those animals we did get to handle while they were awake and adorable little baby. So that was super special. You know, that's one of the most fun things, because a lot of our animals, you know, like the lions and tigers, we can certainly train for some behaviors, which is so wonderful. Like they'll do some voluntary behaviors for medical skills. So like some animals will let us do voluntary blood draws or show us their mouth or different body parts. But to actually get hands on most of our animals, they need to be under anesthesia.
Yeah. And just thinking anesthesia, I've spent a lot of time with my daughter at the Animal Kingdom at Disney. And one of the favorite places to go to is the vet area where they actually do surgeries. We've seen surgeries on zebras and even a snake once. It, always very interesting to see the contraptions. I shouldn't call them contraptions. I mean, they're very well put together procedures for actually anesthetizing a whole variety of animals. It's sort of not like people, you know, everybody's a little different.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, some of our animals, we need to create different like squeeze cages. Like for example, a porcupine, you know, you can't exactly hold a porcupine. So we have a really great maintenance team also that'll work together with us to figure out the best ways to create some sort of like a squeeze cage for a porcupine that we can then safely get an injection to. So yeah, it's definitely a lot of MacGyvering at the zoo.
Well, I've spent a lot of time at the Henry Vilas Zoo, so I feel like I know a little about it, Beth, but maybe give us the broad picture here of the Henry Vilas Zoo.
Sure. So our zoo is coming up on 110 years old. So we are definitely one of the oldest in the nation. And then, you know, really our, you know, proudest thing that we have that we want to share as much as possible is that we are a free zoo. So anybody in the state, anybody that is interested in coming can come 365 days a year. And we are open year round, even on holidays. So keep that in mind. Next time you have some spare moment while the turkey's roasting on Thanksgiving Day, we are open that day. So the zoo has come and made so many changes, especially, you know, since I was young and visiting as someone back in the 80s and 90s, and now where we are today with some of the, you know, some of our biggest endeavor, new exhibits with our Arctic Passage that opened up about 5 years ago, is just, it's just so exciting to see some of the changes that the zoo has made. And, you know, zoos as institutions across the U.S. and further are all making dramatic changes to how we display animals, how we teach people about animals, how we treat animals that are under our care. And it's a really exciting time to be here and seeing some of these changes and being able to be a pivotal part of how, you know, the greater Madison area or the Wisconsin visitors, or even, you know, visitors that we might get from out of state, are able to see how our institution, being, you know, free for anyone, is able to still provide a world-class experience for people coming to learn about polar bears and see polar bears swimming in a, you know, huge pool that they can view them underwater, or, you know, be able to read a sign, even if they can't see the polar bears, that we're giving the polar bears the choice to move to a cooler area if they're interested. So, you know, some of the most exciting things about giving animals choices and making them participate in their own medical care, like Dr. Thurber was talking about a little bit earlier, and the way that zoo professionals are working towards teaching the people that are visiting or interested in learning about animals. So I would definitely say the last year in COVID has taught us a whole new way of reaching guests too, and that the power of social media and all of the virtual ways that people can still be engaged with these animals. They have, we often call them our ambassadors. And so we have ambassadors that are polar bears. We have ambassadors that are little tiny tortoises. And, you know, depending on the person and depending on the situation, they can make a really big impact for people, you know, like myself that visited the zoo when I was little and just thought it was a wonderful place. Or maybe some people that aren't so sure about zoos or come to it maybe with a little bit more skepticism, that if they meet some of our staff and have a chance to talk to them, would see how some of these animals are, you know, all of these animals are treated with the utmost respect and greatest intent for their welfare to be at the highest level at all times. So that's why, you know, like I was saying earlier, having some signs up that talk about an animal being off exhibit because it's, you know, maybe too warm out for them and they prefer their cooler off exhibit holding area, or if an animal's under medical care for one reason or another, that might be another reason that we don't have them on exhibit, because they need that time and a little bit of privacy for healing. So, you know, zoos in their way of creating these new exhibits too are moving away from how many animals can we display all at once to how big of a space can we give the animals that we do want to highlight, making sure that the climate that you're building your, you know, that your zoo is in and that you have the next exhibit being built in is an appropriate one for whatever animal you might be thinking about. You know, being a northern zoo here in Wisconsin, we definitely have seasonal changes, and we have to think pretty closely when you think of some of these African species that people are often very excited to see when they come to the zoo, or, you know, considered like, you know, a signature species. We have to think about, like, if you have them out in Wisconsin for, you know, 7 or 8 months, what are you doing with them for the other 3 or 4 months? Are they able to have a great experience, even if they can't be outside due to Wisconsin's wintertime? So really having the, you know, species requirements in mind, and building new zoo exhibits or accommodating old exhibits to make sure that the animals are getting, you know, the best comfort that they can in a colder climate like ours.
Very, very cool. Dr. Mary Thurber and curator Beth Peterson, our guest today from the Vilas Park Zoo, talking about how the zoo operates, talking about care of the animals, and inviting you to join in as well, and I hope you will. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. taking a look at what's new at the zoo and what's new in zoo operations with our two guests, Dr. Mary Thurber, Curator Beth Peterson. Certainly, if you have a question or comment, or maybe an experience to share at the zoo, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. I'll tell you one experience that I had with my mother, who had Alzheimer's disease, unfortunately, and I would bring her to the zoo, the Vilas Park Zoo, every Saturday in season. And it was always like she was visiting it for the first time. And she always went away very happy. The animals, she enjoyed the animals so much, but I think she even more enjoyed watching the little children and their excitement and the fun that they were having. And just to think about that for a minute, the zoo, in my mind, is very accessible. Wheelchair accessible, things of that nature, Beth.
Yeah, certainly as we are planning for new exhibits or even modifying our old viewing areas, we're accessible to all with our free admission price. And then also being mindful of any sort of visitors that we might have that English is not their primary language. So over the last few years, we've been making sure to have some signs in Spanish as well as English, which probably opens up a lot more educational opportunities for some of the folks that might be coming and wanting to learn about the animals. As we modify fence lines or think about some of the public ways that we wind through the zoo, there's certainly a lot of opportunities that we've seen in the last couple of years in particular to make sure that maybe the railings go differently so that someone that is in a wheelchair or even, you know, like you said, a lot of families that are coming in strollers that would be able to see through the fence line a little bit differently. All of our indoor buildings are one level as well. So there's never any steps or anything that people would have to work through. But for the most part, I think we're always looking for more opportunities. We recently, right before, it must have been in 2019, we're also certified through Culture City as having sensory inclusive zones. So some folks that may have a harder time with loud noises or a lot of activity going on, we're able to offer them like a little bit of a package at the front gate that would include things like earmuffs or some fidget spinners or heavy lap bean bags that might help calm them down because, you know, everybody experiences the zoo differently. Sometimes it can result in a lot of loud talking by some guests and say, oh my gosh, did you just see him do that? And other people prefer to sit back and observe a little bit more. So you never know, you know, depending on which exhibit you're going to, whether you have a macaw screaming or whether you have a lion roaring and making sure that, you know, all of our guests that come through hopefully are able to still enjoy their experience, even if some of those unexpected noises can be a little bit more alarming for them. So we're continuing to improve, and there's a great community in Madison with the Children's Museum and the Nature Center that we've been able to really network with.
Well, as you were talking, I was thinking about my colleagues from my department, Life Sciences Communication. I'm a professor there, Dr. Lloyd Bostian and his wife Jenny had a home very close to the zoo, and it was always fun when we were invited over for dinner in the evening to suddenly hear a lion roar. You know, you're in the backyard and here's a lion roaring. It was always pretty cool. Let's take some calls. Elroy and Loyal, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. When our family traveled, or especially if my wife and I go to CE meetings in other cities, we do like to visit other zoos. I'd like your unbiased opinion, of course, on what you would consider the top 10 must-see zoos to visit the United States.
Ooh, well, Dr. Mary, do you want to? I can think of a couple, but go ahead. Let's hear what you've got.
I would say it depends on what you're looking for. I was pretty fortunate in my residency training program to work at several zoos and institutions on the West Coast. So I'm particularly biased towards the San Diego Zoo and San Diego Zoo Safari Park. But really, there are so many world-class zoos across the U.S. and the world. I don't know that I necessarily could make a specific top 10, but you know, a lot of the zoos, I think making sure that they are AZA accredited is really important. So that's the American Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And so that's the institution that makes sure that all the animals in that institution are being managed with, you know, high quality welfare, world-class, you know, medical care. So making sure they fit into that. But I'd be happy for either of you to come up with your list. You know, I don't want to bias everyone.
but that's good to be able to look for. What do you look for when you see, what's the accreditation again?
It's called AZA accreditation.
AZA accreditation. Yeah, the San Diego Zoo is something else. And we found the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. to be quite an experience as well, Elroy. So there's two, but that AZA accreditation is what to look for sure. Okay. Well, let's go to Chris in Janesville. Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say we've been to the Henry Vila Zoo many, many times. We live in Janesville, so we come, you know, at least once a year, usually a couple times a year. But the problem is that there's never anywhere to park. And I was wondering if there's anything that can be done about that. It looks like there is some area that could be turned into more parking. But when you have to go on those side streets, it's so tight to begin with in that area with all the housing and the narrow streets. I wish there was a better way to do it because that you never know where you're going to be able to park. And, you know, with three kids, you're trying to walk four or five blocks. I mean, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Beth, I'll turn that one to you, I guess. And I understand.
I can give it my best effort. So, like I said earlier, being a 110-year-old zoo, they did not plan particularly well when deciding that this was our footprint here at the zoo, you know, a century ago. So I always remind guests to keep that in mind. I know as a parent myself, that doesn't necessarily make it any easier with the stroller and the diaper bag as you're bringing in maybe or bringing out some tired young zoo guests with you. Interestingly enough, the county is our, the zoo is owned by the county. So we are a county entity and we are county employees, but anything outside our perimeter gate is actually the City of Madison parks. So if you're familiar enough with the zoo, we have two main parking lots. And on one side, we are bordered by Lake Wingra, so no parking options there. Mm-hmm. And then on our west side, we have what we call as the Shoe Park, but I think it's probably officially called like Wingra Park or something like that. And that is a beloved community staple, almost as much as the zoo, I would say. So likely not a lot of parking options in the future there as that park space and that green space is really valuable as what it is, as a beloved playground. I know I went down the Shoe when I was little. So, we are always looking into more parking options. It's something that we have to work closely with the city on. And I agree that there can be days that it's particularly hectic with parking and that you never quite know what you're going to get when it comes to street parking. I wish I had a better response, but it's one of the symptoms of being situated in a very old neighborhood and being a very old zoo and not having a lot of a footprint that we can devote to that, unfortunately. So I think that's all I got on that one.
Yeah, you know, you could turn the parking, the one parking lot into a ramp, I guess, but that would really also screw up the aesthetics of the place. pretty big time. So it's always a little adventure because the zoo is popular and there are people there, a lot of people there. So that's the good part of that. That's the good part of that. A listener emailed, she lives in Chippewa Valley, been to the Irvine Park Zoo a number of times, hasn't had to take her 4-year-old there because the animals seem to be in a mental state, so hyenas and tigers and bears pacing back and forth, repeating the same laps inside their cages, maybe some rocking back and forth in that at that particular zoo. That's disturbing. What are, maybe talk about that behavior, Dr. Mary, and what are some things that should be done to help animals out?
Sure. One of the words we might use for a behavior like that would be a stereotypic behavior. So that's a behavior that doesn't necessarily have like a goal for their, you know, day-to-day function. And so what we often will try to do in a zoo setting is provide lots of enrichment for animals. That's really important for their welfare. So the keeper staff is really great at knowing, what their animal likes to do during the day, how they can try to change up their day, whether that's providing them with new smells, different types of toys that are safe for them, moving things in their environment so that, you know, things change and it makes them stimulated during the day. Also working on training. So working on training for medical behaviors, I of course particularly appreciate. So working with their animals so that they actually have to do different behaviors potentially to get some of their diet. That way they're not just given, you know, a bowl of food that they can eat all at once and then they're, you know, they're done eating. In the wild, most animals do spend a lot of their day foraging or, they have to work to get some of their food as opposed to just finding it sitting in a bowl. So finding different ways to integrate feeding their diet throughout the day, making them do different behaviors, whether it's something like training for a voluntary hand injection, using that to really make their day more interesting and more varied contributes to their welfare, definitely. So I'd say we're really lucky that we have such a wonderful team here at the Henry Vile Zoo that we really don't see very many stereotypic behaviors at all. And a lot of that is due to the really great environments and the enrichment that the keepers are able to provide.
Yeah, there's been some really great updates, like to the polar bear exhibit, for example. That's a great exhibit. And I think that kind of space and also helps.
Definitely.
Having that kind of space.
Exactly. Having as big of a space as you can, providing them different opportunities to choose, like Beth was mentioning earlier. We like to make sure that they get to choose what they're doing with their day as well. It's really important.
Yeah, that makes good sense. I'm wondering about, you know, how the animals reacted during COVID. I mean, I assume that a lot of animals like to see people, and that may have had some impact. Or maybe talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So it was a little difficult to see because I think, you know, we also are humans that were going through very much the same anxious times like a lot of people last spring. And we were separating ourselves from each other since, maybe Dr. Thurber can talk a little bit more about this at a different time. But like, we also are dealing with COVID susceptible animals. So we isolated ourselves quite a bit in our day to day routines of who's seeing each other on their lunch hour, who works closely on a training session with an animal together, to make sure that even though we were always wearing masks, always wearing gloves, sometimes we were wearing face shields, that we were always, you know, protecting the animals as best as we could, but there's still that zoonotic risk. So that a zoonotic disease is anything that can be passed from people to animals or animals to people. So even the common cold is something that can be a zoonotic disease. And so with the early unknowns around the coronavirus, we We're able to work with Dr. Thurber and the rest of the vets that we work with to identify which species were our most COVID susceptible animals. So that would include all of our primates, all of our big cats, a group of animals called mustelids, which includes ferrets, badger, otters, skunk. And then also our bats were another group that that we weren't sure about their level of susceptibility, but had heard that there was, possibility of having some of the origin of the coronavirus surrounding bats. So we were also doing a lot of changes to our day-to-day routine during those early months of coronavirus because we were so desperate to keep the animals safe. That's our number one job, is to keep people and animals safe. And so we would hate the idea if we ever got any of them sick or unknowingly brought anything in that would be harder for them to combat than it was for us. Our animals range in ages. So we, just like people, we have some geriatric animals. We have some younger animals that might not have a fully developed immune system quite yet either. From the guest perspective, we were closed about 3 months in the beginning. And I'd say during that time, we definitely noticed that the primates, I wouldn't say that they're bored, because the keepers were certainly doing above and beyond to get them everything they need, like the enrichment that Dr. Thurber was talking about. And they were still able to go outside during that time, even though the zoo is closed. But I think there's a certain level of people watching from primate to primate that even if it is pretty subtle, whether it's the lemur sitting up on their bench and kind of just watching as some guests go past. Some of the orangutans are a little bit more obvious with theirs and might be down in front and watching, each of the babies in the strollers, or seeing, like, you can never quite tell. Sometimes it seems like some colors are particularly interesting to them, like someone has on a bright red scarf, and that might seemingly draw more interest than a different guest. So they definitely do some people watching. I kind of equate it to like maybe having a TV on in the background of your house all of the time, and that it's kind of always on. It might catch your interest every once in a while, but not all the time. So I think those are the main ones that we kind of noticed maybe just missing out a little bit. But yeah, they were also probably some of the ones that we saw great responses from when guests did start to trickle back in. And they've also been really used to us wearing masks all along. So it was a pretty easy hump to get over as far as having all guests also being masked at that time.
No. Dr. Thurber, anything to add there?
Yeah, it's a great topic. We were fortunate that we were able to talk not only, amongst ourselves about what we were concerned about with COVID, but also networking with, the zoos across the country. AZA has a really great communication streamline to managers, curators, zoo directors, and veterinarians across the country and the world. And then different zoo veterinarian groups also were having lots of different conversations about COVID and who we were concerned about. So we were able to implement our PPE very early on in COVID. And we've been very fortunate that we have not had any animals having any clinical signs or symptoms concerning for COVID. So I think we did a really wonderful job.
Well, let's take some more calls. Mona in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mona. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I love this talk. I'm crazy about animals and zoos. I've got a question and a recommendation. I got two questions. Have any of you been to the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum in Tucson? Because I would highly recommend that. And my question is, do you know of any other places in the country like that that focus just on localized species?
Dr. Thurber?
Yeah, we actually have institution fairly close to Madison out in Poinet called the McKenzie Environmental Center. And that is a DNR facility here in Wisconsin that actually only exhibits local wildlife. So it's a really great place to go learn about the native Wisconsin animals. And I happen to know about it because I also provide veterinary care for them as well. But it's a really great place to go learn about Wisconsin's native wildlife.
And I have been to the Sonora Desert Zoo, and it is a fabulous place. with very natural settings for the animals there that are there. So, yeah, it's a beautiful place, Mona, for sure. See, did we answer all of her questions? I think we did. Mona, thank you. Appreciate
the
call.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Hi. I just wanted, I have a comment and a question. My husband and I enjoyed walking through the zoo towards spring on cold days and watching how the animals reacted to people coming by them. Some of them were very responsive. Of course, the badgers, the tiger, the otters. And we got to know the sandhill crane called Buckbeak. And we found out from one of the workers there, one of the younger people, that you were he was there for rehabilitation. My question is, do you do that sort of thing often? And has Buckbeak graduated from the zoo, or will he stay there?
All right. Who wants to take that one, Dr. Thurber? Or let's go to Beth. Hi, Beth.
So I think you got some of the right information. And of course, I don't know who you talked to, Barbara, but Buckbeak is here to stay. He is a rescued sandhill crane, and he definitely has quite a personality. He actually was placed with us through the International Crane Foundation, which is our, a great resource in our little Wisconsin network up in Baraboo there. And my understanding of Buckbeak's previous history is that he was found in a retail parking lot and was getting very close to people, which is not normal crane behavior. So at that point, he was quite young, and ICF, the Crane Foundation, took him in and just did a thorough health check to make sure that there wasn't anything physically wrong with him that was preventing him from having that innate fear of humans, which is kind of important for being surviving day to day, and to make sure that there wasn't anything, physically wrong with him that could prevent him from being successful as a wild crane. So he came out with a clean bill of health and was released back to one of their designated sites. And sure enough, Buckbeak occurred back in a parking lot, not very much later. And at that point, for his own safety and for the safety of people, he was taken back into their custody and then placed with us. So he definitely has a huge personality. He's a great bird to work with. He definitely is interested in people. And you can see why that would be problematic, especially when he seems to have a propensity to end up in parking lots. One inattentive driver could mean that Buckbeak could be placed in a really precarious situation. They are formidable birds. Ask anybody, ask anybody that works at the Crane Foundation. They, if they don't respect personal space, there's a lot of people that can be very threatened by that and not feel comfortable with having, quote unquote, a nuisance crane that's kind of following people in their parking lot. So for something like that, we are happy to provide a home for him. And he does have wild cranes that will visit him just on the other side of our fence, usually over by Lake Wingra. And so Buckbeak's here to stay. We don't expect that there'll be a time that he is any less interested in people from what he's shown us in the last few years. But he is a beloved member of our zoo family, certainly.
So there you go, Barbara. Thanks so much. Well, this could have been some imprinting issue that happened at his early stage, Dr. Thurber, that maybe resulted in that.
Yeah, that is definitely something that can happen with animals when especially if they're very young and they're exposed to humans, potentially if somebody was feeding him, so he thought that humans would be a source of food. So it's definitely a reason that it's not good to be feeding the local wildlife, not only to try to prevent something like imprinting, but also usually when humans are feeding wildlife, not necessarily their normal appropriate diet. And so that can cause some, GI upset as well. So trying to let the wildlife, do their own thing, take care of themselves is usually recommended. But certainly if you ever did see wildlife that seemed to be injured, it would be great to call somebody like the Dane County Humane Society Wildlife Center is one of the great local resources for wildlife if you ever had a question. And definitely would recommend reaching out to them, and they can provide great recommendations for what to do next.
Our guest today, Dr. Mary Thurber and curator Beth Peterson of the Vilas Park Zoo in Madison, talking about care of animals at the zoo, talking about zoos in general a bit too. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at what's new at the zoo, we're talking with some representatives from the Vilas Park Zoo, its curator, Beth Peterson, and also Dr. Mary Thurber, who is the primary veterinarian at the zoo. Join in with your questions. What do you like about zoos? What do you like about the Vilas Park Zoo? Questions about zoos in general, about animals, the wild animals that are at the zoo. Love to hear from you. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Mary, maybe you could talk about the UW Vet School's zoological program and maybe about requirements for being certified to treat zoo animals.
Absolutely. You know, we are really fortunate at the vet school that our program has just been growing and growing. So right now we currently have 4 veterinarians who are board certified in zoological medicine. So we're diplomats of the American College of Zoological Medicine. And we actually cover for 3 different services. So starting this summer, we have a brand new rotation for our 4th year veterinary students in wildlife medicine. We also have a rotation at the vet school, which is specifically for our exotic pets. So like people who own parrots, rabbits, guinea pigs, snakes, bearded dragons, the animals that come to the vet school. So we call those our special species at the vet school. And then we also have our zoological medicine service. And that has been going on for about 2 years now that we've had the relationship with the Henry Vilas Zoo. We also provide veterinary care for the McKenzie Center, like I mentioned earlier, as well as the Oxnard Park Zoo in Baraboo. And so for those different services, we have veterinary residents. So those are veterinarians who've already gone through school and usually 1 or 2 internships, which is a 1-year program. And then they've gone into our residency program in zoological medicine. And so they will go through working with one of the board certified veterinarians in their training program. And then we'll also have 4th year veterinary students who get to rotate through all of our different services in a 2-week block, getting exposed to all the different ways to take care of wild and exotic animals, whether it's in a zoo setting, a wildlife rehab, or at the vet school itself. There are many different ways to become a zoo veterinarian, and you can act as a veterinarian without being a board-certified zoo vet. But if you wanted to become a board-certified zoo veterinarian, typically there are a couple different pathways. Obviously, you go to college and then vet school. Once you graduate vet school, typically you'll do a 1-year internship that's sort of generalized either in small animal medicine and surgery or large animal medicine and surgery. Large animals would be, you know, like horses and cows and goats, things like that. And then our typical small animals is mostly dog and cat medicine. After that 1 year, a lot of people will go on to do a 1-year internship in zoo or exotic or wildlife medicine. So doing a 1-year internship after that, then you can get into a residency program. So the residency is a 3-year program. There are several across the country. So then that way you would have done enough schooling to credential to be able to sit for boards. You also have to write 3 first author papers that are published. At least one of them needs to be a prospective research study. The other 2 could be additional research studies, or they could be something like a case series or a retrospective looking at something of interest in zoo and wildlife animals. The other pathway is sort of called the experiential pathway. So instead of doing a residency, you can actually work as a zoo veterinarian for 6 years, and that would be equivalent to doing a 3-year residency program, and you still have to write those 3 papers. Then you get to sit boards. Boards is a 2-day exam. So you have to pass day one to make it to day two. And then if you pass day two, you are a diplomat of the ACZM, American College of Zoological Medicine. And it's definitely a very rigorous exam. I'd say on average, there's maybe a 30% pass rate per year. So definitely challenging, but worth it.
And so then, you'd have to take it again, or try to take it again. And by the time you're done, you've got a couple of years and then it's time to retire.
Pretty much.
It almost feels like it, but there are opportunities. I know I'll just go back to, Animal Kingdom at Disney there. I talked to vets there who were graduates of UW.
Great.
And spoke very fondly of their time there, or here, I should say. Where else do you have graduates around the world, different places?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually also went to the UW for vet school. We do have a really great track record for getting our students into zoological medicine. Some of my mentors at my program, my residency program in San Diego, were also graduates from the UW vet school. So yeah, we definitely do sort of have made it across the world, really. But there are certainly opportunities, you know, in all the different vet schools. Not all of them actually have their own zoo veterinarians that are board certified on staff. More and more of them do have them, but we have a really unique program here now, especially having the three different services. And we are actually adding a fifth faculty member this summer as well. So our program keeps growing, which gives more and more opportunities for our students. And really that just benefits animals everywhere, because even if our students don't necessarily become a board certified zoo veterinarian, even if they get exposed to how to take care of birds and reptiles and some of the non-traditional animals, they can, you know, provide veterinary care or at least provide recommendation to people who might need help, whether it's a pet or wildlife, or even consulting with a local zoo that might not have a full-time veterinarian. So being able to reach, you know, so many animals that way by educating our students and giving them their opportunities is really, you know, such an important part of our job. That's really, really fulfilling.
Yeah, it's got to be. A caller couldn't stay online, wondered what you think of the Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque.
I can't say I've ever been there.
Beth Peterson,
I've been there many times, and I think it's a great resource. That's another good example of an area that is highlighting just their regional wildlife for the most part and educating about those native animals, which can be really impactful. You know, we're all always excited to share our giraffe or our rhino. But, you know, for people that are local and seeing some of these wildlife in their own backyard or maybe on the Mississippi River catching some of these fish, learning something about them or whether they are endangered or what some of the pressures they might be facing could be, you know, much more integral to their day-to-day goings-ons compared to learning about a rhino that lives in Africa. So,
yeah,
I love the Mississippi River.
My daughter Emily, who will be starting college in the fall to become a marine biologist, had volunteered a couple of years in a row, summers, at the zoo. And maybe you could just mention volunteer opportunities and how it might relate. She kind of liked working with the goats and the kids, to be honest. But there's a training program. Everybody has to go through it early in the year. I sat through part of it with her. And so we talk a bit about that.
Yeah, certainly a lot of our opportunities have changed in the last year. We had to put some of them on hold, but it almost gave us a little bit of a chance to reevaluate exactly what our needs are for volunteers too. So we are looking forward to opening the goat yard back up, even if it's just for one day a week, which means we'll need some goat yard volunteers. And I know we already have a ton of those that have just been waiting. We also have volunteers that help us with our train and our carousel, which, you know, some people just really love interacting with the kids and the guests that way. And maybe You know, since that's a revenue generator for the zoo, that's a great way to be an important part of raising money for the zoo when we aren't asking for an entry fee, by putting some money in when you visit, whether it's through the train or the carousel or our concession stands, is a great way to support us. In addition to anything you might drop in one of our donation boxes. So we also have volunteers that help with gate greeting right now. And so kind of having a little bit of a face that kind of puts your zoo visit, it connects it with a zoo employee, even if they may be a volunteer that's greeting you at the front gate, has been something really important, obviously, during the last year of some masking restrictions. And we're so thankful for some of our volunteers that came out to help with that job. And it's been really successful. We've had a ton of wonderful feedback about those volunteers in particular and about how people have felt safe visiting the zoo, which we're really proud of. And then we also have animal handling volunteers, and that's a pretty rigorous process because I think a lot of people think, well, on my day one of volunteering, I'm going to get in and I'm going to give the rhino a good scratch behind his ears. But that actually is not necessarily the path that most of our volunteers are on. But they do get to work up to handling some of our program animals. So we have animals that their job is to be giving a little bit more of an up close encounter. Yeah.
We'll continue that conversation. We'll take a quick look at the news and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking about life at the zoo on the show today, Larry Mueller here with our two guests from the Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. Primary veterinarian Dr. Mary Thurber and curator Beth Peterson. So as we listen to them talk about the zoo, what questions do you have? What do you want to know about how zoos are run? Do you have questions about maybe your favorite zoo animal? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Give us a call, shoot us an email. In fact, Dave in Madison emailed. He and his kids love visiting the Henry Vilas Zoo. His parents brought him to the Bronx Zoo in New York and were members of the World Wildlife Fund. The program today is helping him understand the intention and operation of the local zoo. He's been conflicted about whether to support zoos. On one hand, zoos keep captive animals that maybe should be in their own environment. On the other hand, zoos provide a place for animals that may not survive otherwise for various reasons, including ever-expanding human development into their natural habitat. So David Madison brings up a lot of interesting points. Maybe I could have both of you comment on them. Dr. Mary, you want to start?
Sure, absolutely. You know, a lot of the animals in zoos at this time have actually mostly been born in captivity or under managed care. And so they most likely would actually not survive well in the wild. And so really only specific programs that are purposely breeding to reintroduce animals to the wild, which is a really important part of a lot of zoos. And those animals usually are actually behind the scenes. So those aren't animals you would necessarily get to see, because the hope for those animals is that they don't think that they should be near people. So when they are released back to the wild, they will survive and succeed. The huge goal of zoos is really just educating the public. If zoos didn't exist, there wouldn't be a way for people to go see these animals for many people. They don't have necessarily the opportunity to go see them in the wild. And so this is really a way to educate people and inspire them. You know, for both Beth and I, going to zoos as a kid is what really inspired us to be able to be a part of these programs and really contribute to conservation. So even though potentially the animals you see at the Henry Vilas Zoo aren't going to get to go back to the wild, they're a really important part of breeding programs in a managed setting. So there's a large overarching group within the AZA called the Species Survival Program. And their goal is actually to maintain an appropriate diverse gene pool of our species in zoos. And so they actually have a stud book for our different animals in the zoo. So they know exactly which animals gave birth to which other animals, whose genetics are really valuable. So if we did get to the point where we did want to reintroduce some of these animals back to the wild, we would know which animals have really good genes that they should be contributing to the gene pool, and so that we have a sustainable population in the zoos. So that's actually where a lot of our recommendations for moving our animals between zoos come from when we were talking about quarantine and pre-shipment earlier in this show. And so really, there are so many different moving parts of the zoos, whether it's the animals you see that you get to have those animals sort of inspiring you and those are the ambassadors for their species. But a lot of zoos also contribute to different conservation programs around the world, whether it is, raising money to help sponsor those research projects, conservation projects, whether it's reaching out and educating the children about how they could contribute to conservation in the future, and then also contributing to these species survival plans. So many different ways that we are working to make sure that there are wild animals where they're supposed to be, even if perhaps, the rhino you see at Henry Vilas Zoo isn't going to go back to the wild because he would not survive in the wild, but he is there to help educate you and make you excited and have a passion for saving those animals back where they do live in the wild.
Yeah, all good points. As you were talking, I was thinking about bats. And I think about the, white nose syndrome, which is seriously affecting our bat populations in Wisconsin and across the country for that matter. And it's possible zoos could play a role in saving that species. Mary.
A good example I always like to share, Larry, is we hold polar bears at our zoo, and the SSP that Dr. Thurber was talking about, there's a polar bear SSP that makes recommendations about animal moves or breeding pairings. And they also are able to field research requests that come through because you would imagine that that doing research on wild polar bears probably is very difficult. They are not all in one spot. They are very spread out. They are dangerous to interact with. So our zoo polar bears are still dangerous to interact with, but we obviously have a much more up close relationship with them than a researcher flying a helicopter over a mom and cubs in Alaska. Another zoo, and unfortunately I can't remember their name at this point, was able to work together on a research project that asked the polar bear to tell the zookeepers when it heard a special noise. It was like a high-pitched, high-frequency noise. And it would tell them that by just opening its mouth or like licking its mouth. And so they were able to train it to say, when you hear this noise, open your mouth and you'll get a reward if you tell us when you hear it. And they were able to translate those results through, animal training in a zoo setting to how affected are wild polar bears in their dens, in their maternity dens, by drilling endeavors or large construction type things? Because, the frequency of sound, is able to travel wide distances. And when they're thinking of protecting specific areas for denning female polar bears and their, resulting offspring, they were able to draw specific areas that were off limits for any sort of construction sound because of the research that was done in the zoo setting that told us polar bears can hear this level frequency or polar bears, seem unaffected by this lower level frequency. And it was able to translate to that field work. And there would really be very little way of finding that out in a wild setting besides seeing how loud you can make the noise before the polar bears ran away or vacated that den.
Yeah.
So, something like that, when you were talking about white nose syndrome, there are these awesome connections that we are able to make by having our zoo ambassadors, help their wild counterparts. And a lot of the times there'd just be no other way to figure out some of that information. And it's something that I just think is so cool. And I'm so excited to share whenever we have people that ask us about our bears or what kind of research might be done. I think usually when people think of research, they think of some really invasive, maybe like not so nice things, yeah. But research can also be, how are you able to train an animal to tell you you know, what frequency of sound it hears, or are you able to take an extra vial of blood from this exotic animal when it's down for its annual exam, getting its vaccinations, getting its thorough checkup from Dr. Thurber. And if you take an extra vial of blood, you know, that vial of blood could be huge for looking ahead to see what normal values are for captive animals, or looking ahead to see what the genetic component for some of these animals could be, and whether it's similar for some of their wild counterparts. So it's something as small as that can really be impactful for some of these wild animals that are struggling to find, you know, the right habitat, or have people be able to identify them and, you know, cordon off areas that are just theirs.
Very, very cool. That's really interesting, that research. Joe in Medford called to ask, how do you decide what animals to have in the zoo, considering you have limited space? And I would add to that, how many animals do we have at the zoo?
We have about 900 animals, but I will say that that includes a whole lot of bugs and a whole lot of frogs, which are very small. I always figured them in because they definitely count. They still get excellent care, even though they're bugs, or invertebrates more scientifically. But when it comes to making decisions for the rest of them, there are so many variables that go into it. I kind of mentioned earlier that we have to be mindful of our northern climate and thinking of are these animals going to get to be outside for most of their time? Are they going to maybe struggle with some of our warmer Wisconsin August, you know, humid times? There's always that component of like, is it something that we think will do help us educate guests? You know, if you're picking a type of snake that prefers to stay in a den and be covered up all of the time, you may not have as many opportunities to have that guest wow moment of like, wow, I can see that the sign says that this snake is a terrestrial snake that likes to hide under a pile of sand. If you don't get to see that animal, then it might be a little bit harder to get that connection. And then there's also the availability of some animals. Like Dr. Thurber mentioned, many of our zoo residents are third, fourth, fifth generation, even captive wild animals. So we are not going on some sort of safari trip to go and find an exotic African antelope that we want to bring back to bring to our zoo. We do have to rely on other institutions at times to say, okay, there's many impala that are available and other institutions want to share them with other zoos. So that would be a readily available animal that, you know, is a great education opportunity, fits well in our current space, and also might do pretty well with our Wisconsin weather. So then there's always like the idea that we want to be contributing to the conservation messages that can go out to. A lot of our SSP animals are often endangered as well. So our orangutans, our Amur tiger, our golden lion tamarins, you know, when we think about adding a new space, we really should be thinking of carving out space for those animals that need it the most, that need our protection in zoos and need space to be breeding. So that, you know, like what Dr. Thurber said earlier, that if there is a time in the future that we have a chance to release any of these, you know, the grandchildren or great grandchildren of our current animals that we've contributed in that way.
Lots there. I, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the very large snakes. Can't remember
anacondas?
The species. Anacondas. And Dr. Mary, I'm wondering, how do you treat one of those? I mean, I forget how long they are, but they're pretty big.
Yeah, and we actually do have two in the zoo that we have actually been discussing recently how we are going to do their routine health exam. So that will be a first exciting opportunity for us. One of their keepers has been working on designing sort of an area that they could encourage the snakes to move into on their own so that we don't necessarily have to go in and try to, you know, catch them up out of the water, try to make it as safe for the animals as well as for the humans. So having the snakes voluntarily participate is always a benefit if we can make that happen. So trying to train the snakes to come into a different area where it will be much easier to get hands on them. And then typically something like that is going to be a many person endeavor. So we like to have people every few feet along the snake to help restrain, to make sure that everyone is safe, the animal doesn't get hurt, and no people get hurt. Takes a lot of teamwork and a lot of coordination, but it definitely can be done.
How long are they? I've forgotten how long those two are.
They're pretty long. Know if we've ever
probably around 12 feet or so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're you wouldn't want to go in there on your own to work with them for sure. Well, I wanted to mention there are behind the scenes tours, and I wanted to get that in because this is an opportunity for people to see what goes on behind the scenes, obviously. Mm-hmm. And Beth, do you want to talk about that? Or
certainly,
should Mary do it?
I can take care of that. I'll give a really brief overview here. All of the information about them will be on our website, henryvilasu.gov. So you'll be able to find all of the details about those on there, but I can give the overview. And we're really excited to offer these tours. And, you know, I think anybody that's visited the zoo and had a chance to talk to one of our staff, the zookeepers in particular, is able to see the passion and excitement that they have for their jobs. You know, people that come to be zookeepers are not people who want to fly planes for a living or people who like to crunch numbers for a living. They are people who love animals and are excited to be with them every day. So you're able to see kind of like a little bit more of an inside view of that when you have a behind the scenes tour. So it's with one of the staff from our education department, and there's different themes to each of the tours. We recently started a Shell Yeah one, which is some of our ornate box turtles and our Aldabra tortoises, and getting to talk a little bit about some of these native turtle species and then, you know, a much larger tortoise version. We also have an On Wisconsin tour, which is talking a little bit about the history of the bison range and how it did range into Wisconsin, though it doesn't anymore. And then our sandhill crane, good old Buckbeak, and our badgers. And the types of things that you're doing on the tours kind of vary a little bit. So sometimes you might have the opportunity to feed an animal like our bison, some like leaves of romaine, if they're interested in coming over to meet you. And other times you might be creating a special type of enrichment that could get fed to the animal right after that. So an example would be our American badgers have, they really like to dig for their mealworms. And so putting some mealworms inside like a paper lunch bag and then being able to give it to them in that VIP space shows you, you know, the type of natural behaviors that we're trying to encourage with some of that enrichment. So head over to the website, and I know tours fill up pretty quickly. So if you had someone special in your life that you think would enjoy that, or maybe you would enjoy it, I would say we have a ton of adults that definitely come on this, and then a lot of budding zookeepers or zoo veterinarians that are also often on the tours.
Jan called to ask if you could give the address or how to send donations. She really appreciates the zoo.
Yeah, you can certainly send any donations to 702 South Randall Avenue, and that's in Madison, Wisconsin, 53715. And just be sure that if you're sending a check or anything else, that it's made out to the Henry Vilas Zoo. So we really appreciate any donations. Like I said, being free, that's what we rely on really heavily. And we've just been so thankful and amazed about how supportive guests have continued to be, especially over the last year, because many other institutions have had hardships during that time. And not to say that things have been completely perfect for us, but I know that this zoo is a jewel in our community, and the community has shown us over and over again about how they support us. And we just really appreciate all the love. So thank you so much.
So Henry Vilas Zoo, 702 South Randall Avenue in Madison, 53715. Or I wonder, can you donate through online?
Yes, definitely. The website is, again, henryvilasu.gov.
henryvilenszoo.gov, and that might be the easy way to do it. Actually, go there. Are there either of you have favorite animals? Dr. Mary Thurber, you got a favorite one?
You know, it's a tough question. I do love all of my patients, but probably one of my favorites at the zoo right now is our female red panda, Ty. She is not only one of the most adorable animals, their fluffy little faces, but she's also she's very well trained and she's very cooperative for veterinary exams. So she's one of the few patients that I get to, you know, interact with in an awake setting, and she'll actually let us take awake x-rays. She'll let me palpate or feel her tummy to make sure that see whether or not she's pregnant. She's being trained sometimes for ultrasound as well. So just a really great animal to get to interact with, and happens to also be extremely cute. One of my favorites.
I know. My goodness. Beth, what about you?
Oh, it's, we get that question a lot, and I feel like it's like a parent, you're not necessarily supposed to pick a favorite child, but when you have about 900 in the collection, you know, you can narrow it down a little bit. So, for me, you know, I started my career at another zoo and have worked with great apes for a long time. So the orangutans, that I've worked with here and in other places always will have a special part in my heart. And I was actually lucky enough through the zoo to be able to travel to Indonesia and help with, wild orangutan, rehab efforts. So that also made it particularly special. So Datu, our 21-year-old born in orangutan, is probably high on my list, and he knows it too. And then, I also have, so much love for our polar bears, and I talk about them often. They've gone through, we've had a few polar bears that have come, and Barrett, our female, has just been like the welcome wagon for each new polar bear that's come through, and she's such a character to see out on exhibit, sitting up against a wall, like taking it all in, or sunbathing. And then the last one I'd say is our bison. I think people come and are just so amazed by how large they are, and you wouldn't realize how much personality they have, kind of just sitting there looking like cows for the most part, but they really have a ton of personality and are so neat to work around. So don't tell any of the zookeepers, but those would be some of my top species in particular.
Well, I have to say it's been a real pleasure to be able to talk with both of you today, and I think a lot of people learned a lot about what goes on at a zoo and what goes on behind the scenes. And I want to thank you both very much. Hope we can do this again. I have to tell you, once I was on for an event with some folks from the zoo, and they brought a penguin with them. So I had a penguin in the radio studio with me, which was a lot of fun. I know there's events, any events that are coming up, go to the website. You're going to find out what's going on there. And Mary and Beth, thank you again for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you, Larry.
Dr. Mary Thurber and curator Beth Peterson of the Vilas Park Zoo. Wasn't that fun? I really enjoyed having them with us. I hope you did as well. And we'll do it again sometime. And you know what? Here we are out of time. Thank you so much for listening. A roundtable discussion on wildlife topics comes up on tomorrow's show. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.